Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook. And then there were two NFL division previews remaining. It's only the West left to conquer. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And this is the perfect time to remind you to go over to FanDuelSportsbook.com/bet the board. All new player signups available for $1,000 free play. Take advantage of the free bet that's there. If you happen to lose your initial wager, FanDuel will have site credit in your account within 72 hours. Hey, Arizona, we're talking to you. FanDuel will be alive and well just in time for football season. So if you find yourself in the Grand Canyon State, now is the perfect time to sign up with a FanDuel sports betting account. And Payne, I know we checked in on your overall health and wellness earlier this week. Are we making progress in the road to 100% just in time for kickoff next week?
What was the number you gave Monday? 67.5%.
Yeah, I think you told us you were in the high 60s, which would have made you a D student thereabout, similar to your academic prowess during your time in Tallahassee.
I think we're in the high 70 percentile now, leaking into the low 80s. That's where I think I'm at this point.
So you've gone from doubtful to questionable, and by the time that, you know, week one's going to roll around, you'll be probable. So we're in great shape the way I see it.
Well, I don't know if that's quite accurate because I'm here, so I'm playing through it regardless of where we've been. So,
all right,
I mean,
well,
I'm here. There's
tape
no
it
probable.
Up.
There's
be-
no. there's none of that. I'm just here.
Tape it up. Be ready to go. And good time to remind folks that haven't already signed up for our Bet the Board football free roll. You want to share some of those details before we get into the brass tacks for today?
Lots of big details. BetTheBoardContest.com. That easy. Go there, sign up, NFL Pick 5 contest, $6,000 in prizes on the season long, and we also have a weekly winner each of the 18 NFL weeks going on during this season. So bettheboardcontest.com, 100% free to join.
There's nothing that says sports betting prowess more than walking around wherever you call home with your Bet the Board swag pack. Take full advantage of the great opportunities there are to go out there. Go 5-0, get your tiebreakers, walk away with some Bet the Board swag. All right, my friend, we've covered three quarters of the National Football League, and we saved kind of the best for last as far as some of the most competitive divisions in the National Football League. So we may as well start out in my neck of the woods, relatively speaking, with the Arizona Cardinals, who find themselves paying as 6-1 underdogs to win the NFC West this season. Their win total sits at 8.5. You do have to lay a buck and a quarter if you want to go under that total. Third season in the Valley of the Sun for Cliff Kingsbury. The last 2 years have tailed off in the latter half of the schedule. When you look at how this team performed, they lost 6 out of their final 9 games. Second year in a row, as we said, they've fallen apart down the stretch. Arizona, you lead the league in penalties, and you begin to worry about the decision-making and game management that old Cliffy boy has shown since taking over. Last winning season for this franchise came back in 2015, where they were pummeled by the Panthers in the playoffs. But their point differential last year of plus 43, best amongst teams that didn't finish with a winning record, missed out on a postseason berth by virtue of a tiebreaker as the Chicago Bears edged them out. Schedule, though, starts all away from home, where they'll play 3 of 4 on the highway to kick things off. When you look at the Arizona Cardinals, Payne, we know it's all about the offense, but they've also made some pretty good additions, at least in my opinion, on the defensive side as well.
Arizona's tough for me to gauge, and it doesn't help that they're playing in this division, which is probably the most competitive. And I don't really know if I'm sold on Kingsbury yet. And we've mentioned this number a couple times over the years, but I think it's really interesting because it's mind-blowing. You can get an NFL job with a resume like Kingsbury. He was 23-40 at Tech if you remove FCS opponents and Kansas from his record. So it's really interesting from that perspective. Now, he's got a flashy quarterback and Kyler, and Kyler can really stress a defense. There's a lot of big names on offense, some on defense that you mentioned. And when you look at Arizona, I think it looks good from the sense that in 2018, before Cliff got there, this was the worst offense in the league by like a long mile. It was 14% worse than the second least efficient offense. And so you have to give Cliff and Kyler a pat on the back for some of that improvement, but I don't think we've seen consistency. We haven't seen this offense put it all together. You mentioned kind of some of the up and down performances. There's really high highs followed by abnormally low lows. And so I think this is a really big year for those two guys. Organizations decide on a player's fifth year option at the end of year three. It's like roughly 3 months after the Super Bowl. It's in May sometimes. So Arizona is going to have to figure out if they're going to pick up Kyler's option. If they choose not to, that likely signals that Cliff's days are pretty numbered. So I think there's a lot of pressure on Arizona. Steve Keims clearly knows that because he's made some offseason moves that are win now for sure. And so to me at this point, when I look at Kyler, he's a guy with a monster arm and he can really move, but he hasn't shown to be a consistent passer. He hasn't shown that he can dice you up when defenses know pass is coming. He hasn't proven that he can throw to all parts of the field. And I think we've kind of broke that over the years on his decline in passing when he tries to throw over the middle. But when I look at Arizona's offense last year and try to project ahead, I'm still left with a ton of questions because I think what we are going to hear and what we have read, and Todd, I think we text each other back and forth about this. If you are buying the Cardinals this year, you're going to hear something of this sort, right? That there were two versions of Kyler, that there were two versions of Arizona's offense, and they were basically pre-shoulder injury Kyler and post-shoulder injury Kyler.
Yep.
And that's what you're going to hear if you're making a case for Arizona, because Kyler was injured in week 11. It happened early in the Seattle game. Now, if you look pre-injury Kyler, he averaged a yard more per pass attempt. He had a sack rate that was 2% lower. He had a positive EPA per pass. His ADOT was almost a full yard higher. He averaged 2.5 more yards per carry. His EPA per rush was 150% higher. I mean, Kyler was substantially better without the injured shoulder, and Arizona's offense was substantially better. They were top 11 in rushing efficiency, passing efficiency, and overall efficiency the first 11 weeks. And so now that Kyler's healthy, everyone expects that type of offensive production. And listen, it could come to fruition, especially when you factor in the schedule. It's projected to be a bottom third of the league schedule of overall defenses, passing defenses, and third down defenses. Projected bottom five schedule of pass rushing defenses and explosive pass defense. So it all sounds great, but I need to see more. And I think there's some other things that are kind of being neglected when you talk about this dip from their offense. Two things changed. The first was the schedule. The first 9 weeks, Arizona faced the second easiest schedule in the league. Great opening week win against San Francisco. But after that, it was basically like games against Dwayne Haskins and Detroit and Carolina and the Jets and Dallas's first game with Dalton. And then you had the come from behind overtime win at home against Seattle after being down double digits with under 3 minutes to go. From week 10 on, the schedule is much more difficult. But the largest change and something that could really rear its head this season, because it's a copycat league, and you kind of hit on this perfectly. It's like, what is Cliff Kingsbury? And really what happened is Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick potentially stole another young offensive mind soul here, right? Because if you go back to week 12, the Cardinals were in New England, and Belichick threw Cliff and Kyler this ridiculous 12-6 curveball. The Patriots went uber small on defense. Five or more defensive backs played almost 99% of snaps that game. 69% of snaps, two or fewer defensive linemen were on the field for New England. Belichick had defensive backs replacing linemen. he used this like speed defense to combat, obviously, the mobile Kyler Murray and this air raid offense, and it worked. Arizona ran 70 plays. They averaged 4.3 yards per play, 4.4 yards per pass. Kyler had a pick, no touchdowns. Arizona didn't record a single explosive pass in that game. And while the rest of the defenses that Arizona faced didn't do that at the rate Belichick did week 12, they sure as shit noticed and mimicked some of that, right? I mean, Arizona saw far more dime formations the final six games. They saw far more two lineman sets. Arizona saw lighter boxes that were daring them to run. From week 12 on, when Belichick kind of threw this curveball and other defenses stole some of the pages from that book, Arizona averaged 8.2 points less. Their yards per play declined 1.2 yards, and their efficiency decreased over 30%. So Cliff's going to see more of that this year now that teams have had a full offseason to study this. He didn't show an ability to adapt last year, but I think if obviously he wants to keep his job, I think he's got to have something to combat this, and hopefully he's identified it. You know, that's the biggest thing here, Todd.
What do you make of some of the Cardinals' offseason additions from an offensive standpoint? They lose Kenyon Drake. He goes off to the Raiders. Larry Fitzgerald's status very much up in the air. Said he doesn't have a desire to play football as it stands right now. If you believe Larry at face value, it suggests that he might not be out there. Now, if you read A.J. Green's comments, A.J. says, well, he didn't rule it out completely. He just might not want to be a part of training camp. And they go out there. You bring in James Conner from Pittsburgh, Green, who I mentioned, on a one-year deal from the Cincinnati Bengals. You bolster the offensive line with Rodney Hudson. And you draft kind of a Swiss Army knife player that we've talked about at great lengths in the college ranks in Rondale Moore to try and help. But it's a receiving group that, after DeAndre Hopkins last year, we haven't seen much out of Christian Kirk and Andy and Isabella, guys that were very highly touted in terms of their potential impact.
I think that's why there's a ton of optimism, is all the namesakes that were added. You know, Rodney Hudson kind of fell into their lap. They had no idea he was available. I don't think anyone knew that the Raiders were just going to overhaul the entire offensive line. And so Hudson fell into their lap. I like that addition. That's awesome. A.J. Green is a guy that everyone's been bagging on, that's basically been told he's done. He's finished. He's over the hill. But man, if you read some of the camp reports, if you listen to some of the guys on social media that I do trust, A.J. Green has looked fantastic. Now, I don't know if he's going to be able to maintain his health for an entire season, but something to really consider there. Your boy Rondale Moore looks like he has the slot job locked up, and I think he's an interesting component to this offense. Not necessarily a guy that's going to take the top off the defense, but he's going to operate around the line of scrimmage and give Kyler some clean looks and operate with the ball after the catch. So he's an interesting piece. So you do like the weapons that they've added if A.J. Green is being as good as what he's hyped up right now. I mean, there's guys out there that have watched practice and gone to some of the camps, and believe it or not, A.J. Green's looked better than Hopkins, some guys have said. I mean, he's got his speed back. He's got burst. It's just a matter of he can actually do it for a full season.
Yeah, you've just now killed my A.J. Green ADP when it comes to fantasy football. So thank you for that, Payne. I really appreciate it. Hoping that he slipped through the cracks. When you look at this Arizona team, I mean, so much emphasis gets placed on this team offensively. Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury, who we've talked about at great length. But defensively, they were a bit of a surprise last year in a positive manner. Finished the season 10th in defensive efficiency, 7th in weighted DVOA. You look at their points per game defense in the top half of the league. And the reality of it is they shaved nearly 60 yards per game off their pass defense. You read NFL.com, their top 100 players, Buda Baker grabbing all the headlines. You look at the athleticism that they've added specifically in their linebacking core with the likes of Zaven Collins in the draft, Isaiah Simmons, who we've talked about being extremely versatile on the defensive side. Now, they are dealing with some injuries on the back half in the secondary. I don't think that's going to be an issue once the season starts. But defensively, can this Arizona team, especially with the addition of J.J. Watt and the potential return of Chandler Jones, be a lot better than even what we saw last year?
I mean, there were times last year where you wondered how Arizona was doing it defensively. And give Vance Joseph some credit. I mean, he had the fifth most injured defense in the league, but Arizona somehow finished 10th in defensive efficiency. They were 20th. The year prior. So real improvement from below average to top 10 while dealing with some of that injury adversity. And I think people see that top 10 defense and then they add a name like J.J. Watt. And the first pick is Zavian Collins. And Chandler Jones, the best name on paper this defense has, only played 5 games last year. And then you had Isaiah Simmons finally, you know, the light bulb came on down the stretch last year. And the expectation is that he's going to improve upon that now that he knows what the heck he's doing. And if Arizona is going to make a run, it has to be, you know, this top 10 defense. But there are some components to me that do leave me nervous. I mean, Chandler Jones isn't happy. He's requested a trade. Reports are surfacing that J.J. Watt is going to be limited to about 65% of snaps. We'll see if he allows that. But the discussion has been quality over quantity with Watt. No doubt, like, he's a guy that you can play outside and then kick inside on known passing situations with Chandler and Marcus Golden. And then you have Zavion coming in on blitzes in these known passing situations. That's a foursome that's pretty scary to think about. But, I mean, their offense is going to have to build leads for the defense, I think, to kind of take shape and be a top 10 unit again. And on top of that, Arizona is projected to face the very toughest schedule of offenses in 2021. Arizona is going to face the single largest jump of passing offenses year over year. And so when I see that massive jump in competition and start to dig into some of the underlying metrics from last season, it does point to regression here. I mean, the Cardinals were top 10, as we mentioned, but their early down defense was 22nd. I see a unit that somehow finished 9th in defensive pass efficiency, yet PFF graded the entire coverage unit as 9th worst. That doesn't add up. And you take it a step further and see how Arizona defended opposing teams' number 1 and number 2 receivers. They were 20th and 23rd in defensive pass efficiency defending opposing teams' top 2 receivers. They just shut everybody else down. I love Buda Baker, who you mentioned, and calling him a safety, I think, minimizes his talent. True. But I look at the rest of the secondary, and there's some questions there. I mean, Robert Alford turns 33 in October. He hasn't played since 2018. He broke his leg and then tore his pec, so he's missed back-to-back seasons. Malcolm Butler ranked 97th out of 148 qualifying corners in adjusted yards allowed per coverage snap. Byron Murphy made a nice year two leap because they stuffed him in the slot because they figured out he couldn't really defend the outside. So maybe he makes a big year three jump. But basically, he was in the 50th percentile of corners in adjusted yards allowed per coverage snap. He's also finished 60th or worse in success rate allowed both NFL seasons. Now, I don't think Arizona's going to have a bad defense. I just want to caution people that saw a top 10 unit last year that got hit by the injury bug, and then they see names like J.J. Watt being added and just assume, like, whoa, massive improvement. This is going to be one of the best defenses in the league. So I think you want to kind of pump the brakes on that belief.
Going to be a real interesting team to watch. I mean, when you talk about more questions sometimes than answers, you typically look for known commodities. And as it pertains to the Arizona Cardinals, I'm not sure they have a whole lot of them on either side of the ball, as you outlined there. So we'll see, you know, more or less what we're going to get from this team right out of the gates. I think their week one matchup on the road in Nashville against the Tennessee Titans is fascinating, but we'll potentially cover that game in greater detail as we inch closer to week one. When you look at another team in the division that made a massive offseason splash as well, that would be the Los Angeles Rams, who find themselves as $2 underdogs to win the NFC West at FanDuel Sportsbook. Their win total, 10.5, shaded to the under, minus $1.40. When you look at what they've accomplished under Sean McVay's leadership, they've won at least 10 games every season since he's been the head coach. They, of course, make the big splashy deal. You trade Goff and 2 first-rounders to Detroit, bring in Matthew Stafford. And when you look at this Rams as a franchise, they haven't had a winning record in 4 straight seasons since the mid-80s. So clearly a renaissance, resurgence, call it what you will. And the winning record last year came even with a turnover differential of -3, but they were a 500 team in the division. San Francisco has really had their number each of the last couple seasons. But Payne, there's been no bigger proponent and cheerleader of sorts for Matthew Stafford and what he might be capable of accomplishing if he was surrounded by competent pieces in a functional organization. When this trade was made, what kind of ceiling do you think it creates for this Rams offense?
It's interesting because I think obviously the ceiling has risen, but the market certainly accounted for that. And I think at that point, once you got to a number that some places hovered around 11, we started to see pros take the under on the Rams. So that's kind of the interesting dilemma that I'm having in my head. Now, when I just look at them piece for piece, the frontline talent's there. And I think we all respect Sean McVay as an offensive mind. Now, he's probably given a touch more love than he deserves at this point, but no doubt he's damn good. I do think he deserves some credit in the making of this as well. You know, I mean, how many guys would have just kind of sat on their hands with Gurley and Goff? And they went to the Super Bowl in 2019. And then they cut their lead back in March of 2020. They traded away Goff in January of 2021 after both basically signed max deals. So give a young guy some credit that didn't have an ego and was willing to say, oof, I think we're really wrong here. Let's fix this.
Can I ask a question real quick on that? And I think it's important to obviously realize when it's time to cut bait, but what kind of indictment do you think it says of the organization knowing how much money they gave Goff and they gave Gurley only to cut ties with them so soon thereafter?
Well, how do you go about it when you go to the Super Bowl?
No, it's, I mean, it's
I
a
think
great,
that's always,
it's a
that's
great
always
point.
The, yeah, it's always the debate organizations have. Now, we always had question marks about Goff because we knew what Sean McVay was doing for him. And so McVay probably should have been the guy to identify and say, hey, maybe we want to let this play out a little bit more before we give him big money. But when you go to the Super Bowl and you say to yourself, man, I had one of my like worst 2 weeks of preparation. This was a loss on me. We had the defense that locked the Patriots down. This is now on me. I can fix this myself. It's tough when you go to the Super Bowl and it's all young guys. It's not like these guys were, you know, outside their prime. That's the other crazy part about this. So, you know, they definitely should have been a little bit better self-evaluating, but it's really difficult to do. And so they kind of washed their hands of that early, fixed it. We'll see, right? Part of the fix is Matthew Stafford. There's going to be a transition period here, right? Learning a new system and new languages and getting on the same page with new players. But I think from the perspective of what McVay's offense is and wants to be and what Stafford's best traits are, this is a pretty good match. And if you look at Goff, he basically became really risk adverse. Only three quarterbacks averaged lower intended air yards than Goff. Only 45% of his passing yards came through the air. The rest was yak last season. So, I mean, basically all his numbers were a byproduct of McVay and getting guys open and great, you know, receivers after the catch. Stafford's average completed air yards per pass was greater than Goff's intended air yards per attempt last year. And so, you know, you just kind of look at Goff's trajectory each of the last seasons, each of the last three seasons, he kept kind of like, you know, getting in his own head a little bit and just wouldn't push the ball downfield. 7% of passes in 2020 traveled more than 20 yards. That's it. So I think Stafford right away opens up the offense. He's going to be willing to push the ball downfield more. 2 years ago, Stafford had a 19% deep pass rate. Last year, Stafford's passer rating on throws of 20 or more yards was 50 points higher than Goff's. So I think we're probably going to see things from McVay that haven't been on film ever before because Stafford allows him to do some of those things. You know, I really think McVay covered for Goff the last few seasons. Now, it sucks Cam Akers went down and Henderson's battling a thumb injury. It forced the Rams to make a move for Sony Michel Wednesday morning. But I think this is still the best cast Stafford's had around him when you look at an O-line that finished seventh in pass block win rate and line yards. A receiver group with, you know, Woods, Kupp, D-Jax, and Van Jefferson, Higbee at tight end. Far and away, the best designer and play caller Stafford's had in his NFL career. We know the one time, Todd, that Detroit elected to go with an offensive-minded head coach in Jim Caldwell, Stafford produced a winning record. Now, you know, McVay and Goff are going to have to operate against a schedule here of defenses projected to be top 10, but it's easier than what the Rams faced a season ago. And when it comes to the pass game, we're projecting a below-average schedule of pass defenses and pass rushing defenses. So I'm excited about this side of the ball, Todd. In general, though, it doesn't feel like there's a ton of depth on the entire roster. It's a lot of front-end, highly talented guys, and there's some question marks about depth. But I think you have to like the pieces on offense.
You know, it's one of the things that I've seen thrown around, and I kind of like it, describing the Rams roster construction, not only on the offensive side, but defensive side as well. It's that stars and scrubs mentality, where if guys stay healthy and you can keep your best players out there, the sky becomes the limit. Your coaching merits really get tested if you lose a key contributor. And you talked a little bit about running back depth and the injury to Cam Akers prompting them to get Sony Michel to bolster their backfield. You know, what would things look like if they lost one of their top wide receivers? Every team falls off a cliff when you lose your starting quarterback, but it always bears watching when you try and forecast how the Rams are going to be at the end of the season, especially in regards to their win total. Now, defensively, I mean, this is a team, Raheem Morris comes in, he'd be a first-year defensive coordinator there under Sean McVay. They don't really add much. You lose a little bit in the secondary. Troy Hill and John Johnson both taking off. Michael Brockers, they part ways with as well. They did finish number one in the league in scoring defense, allowed the fewest yards per play since the Broncos, who won the Super Bowl back in 2015. One of two teams over the last two seasons, right alongside the Steelers, that have generated 50-plus sacks. And we know about what kind of talent they bring at all the different levels. Aaron Donald, of course, not only the best defensive lineman now, but arguably one of the best defensive players we've seen when you dig into some of the numbers and what he's been able to accomplish. Jalen Ramsey, talking about him potentially changing positions. You talked about it last year. Maybe he could add some value playing in the slot as well. And we know, Payne, anytime a Florida State man changes his number, big things are on the horizon.
Oh, God. I have a tough time with this defense because Brandon Staley was a bit of a surprise last year. He obviously had, you know, decent lineage under Vic Fangio, but he was only an outside linebackers coach for two seasons. And then there was this story about how McVay picked Staley up for his interview at 4 a.m. and it lasted 12 hours because the guys just fell in love with each other. Their principles aligned, and McVay wanted someone young and innovative. He wasn't looking for a guy with tons of experience that was unwilling to adapt to the times. And I think that's what Staley did so well, was building a defense around today's times. He wanted to stop the pass and pressure the quarterback. He didn't focus on the run, but he did want linebackers and guys in the secondary that could react quickly and were willing to tackle once they did identify run was coming. And he wanted guys that were interchangeable. And so that's what we saw last year. Jalen could play outside one week and then in the slot the next. And it obviously helps when you have Jalen and Donald, two of the best at their positions. And, you know, in my heart of hearts, I really do feel like the schedule is partly responsible for the Rams' defensive dominance last season. I mean, this list of quarterbacks is just brutal. Wentz, Daniel Jones, Alex Smith, Kyle Allen, Foles, Tua in his first career start, Nick Mullins, Cam, Sam Darnold. Even the toughest offenses on the schedule came at times when they weren't performing optimally, right? Like, it was Seattle both times after Pete Carroll neutered the offense and demanded more running. It was Tampa before their bye week when they weren't using motion and play action enough. Both Cardinals games were post shoulder injury Kyler. So it was really tough for me to gauge. I mean, Brandon Staley hit the lotto. I mean, went from linebacker coach to head coach and basically inside of 24 months. When you put it all together, the Rams defense played a schedule of offenses bottom eight in overall efficiency, passing efficiency, pass blocking efficiency, third down efficiency. I mean, it was really a brutal schedule of offenses. Now, Raheem Morris, not really sure what he is. Guys are learning their third system in 3 years. You do lose the two key cogs you mentioned in the secondary, and I'm probably a little higher on Johnson and Hill. I mean, Troy Hill allowed 1.03 yards per coverage snap in the slot last season. That was fifth among corners with at least 200 slot coverage snaps. Only five other corners that played at least 100 slot coverage snaps allowed a lower passer rating than Troy Hill. John Johnson was the leader of the defense. He was basically the, you know, conduit between Staley and the rest of the guys. He was their on-field coach and play caller. Extremely versatile. You could play him as a hybrid safety. And basically, he played every single defensive snap last season. And then you mentioned the Rams shipping Brockers to Detroit as well. Then you think about the schedule. And the Rams are going to play a schedule of offenses projected to be top five overall this season. top five in passing and rushing and in the red zone. Todd, this would not shock me in the least if the Rams fell to, 10th or worse in overall efficiency and defensive efficiency this year.
I mean, hey, look, we've talked about it last season in terms of, and you highlighted week in, week out, going, all right, we keep waiting for a chance to go up against the Rams defense, but when you don't play a schedule that allows you to try and do so, you can't force an issue that's not there. So talking about this team falling a little bit defensively, but maybe being able to make up the shortcomings offensively makes them such a fascinating team. And to hear you say that you've seen some professional money as this win total got a touch inflated. I mean, Matthew Stafford as a dark horse MVP, the Rams as a runaway to win the NFC, felt a little bit aggressive, but it's good to see Matthew Stafford getting some love. And I think you and I, who have been fans of his, will be excited to see how he performs matchup with Sean McVay and if the defense can do its part. But the Rams won't be without competition, obviously, in the NFC West, and maybe their biggest challenger, especially on paper, will come from up in the Bay Area. That'll be the San Francisco 49ers, who've actually moved into the favorite role in the division at FanDuel Sportsbook at plus 190. Their win total sits at 10.5 as well, but you only have to lay $1.20 if you want to go over. When you look at the 49ers, last year, more or less a reset season, not necessarily by design, but necessitated because of injuries. They placed 31 players on injured reserve a season ago who missed a combined 95 games from week one starters. Both were most in the NFL. Only Denver finished with a worse turnover differential. And Payne, for all the expectations we have with Kyle Shanahan and how we think the world of what he can accomplish, he's only produced one winning season as head coach in San Francisco. That, of course, the year they were quarter away from winning a Super Bowl with Jimmy Garoppolo as the starting quarterback. We know what the biggest storyline coming out of the Bay Area is, but want to know where you'd like to focus, whether it's on the 49ers offensively or what this defense may look like when completely healthy along that D-line.
I mean, let's start with the offense. Let's, you know, we try to do our best to not hit things the same way as what listeners are being inundated with on television and social media. But sometimes, you know, the topic is so large, we should probably address it and just do it in a little bit more of a sophisticated manner. And so when you look at Jimmy G or when you look at Trey Lance, the reality is Jimmy G's still on the roster. Now, I get it. He's an asset that the 49ers organization can get something for, even though they crushed his value a little bit when you go out and give up the world to get a different quarterback. But I don't think the 49ers are truly ready to move on. I mean, if you look at Jimmy G's cap structure, $26.4 million he's getting paid this year. The dead cap number was only 2.8. So if the 49ers didn't want Jimmy G around or didn't think he could contribute, he would have been gone. And they would have allocated that $23 million to build around Trey Lance. And I don't think Kyle Shanahan's dumb enough to stunt Trey Lance's growth if he's truly the day one starter holding out hope to get a third round pick for Jimmy G. I mean, the reality is when you kind of went over the record there for Kyle Shanahan, and there's some certain questions as to his ability as a head coach still, even though he's one of the best offensive minds. But here's the reality. When Jimmy G has started for Kyle Shanahan, the 49ers have won 73% of those games. When any other quarterback started for Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco, 49ers have won 21% of those games, and everyone just wants to cast the dude off. Like, he's just trash. Like, just throw him to the freaking curb.
He was one quarter away from winning a Super Bowl at one overthrown ball. Now, I know he didn't go out there and throw for 400 yards in that performance, but amazing how much different this narrative would be, Payne. And I know you didn't want to see Kansas City lose that game, but that's neither here nor there. If San Francisco wins that Super Bowl.
What did he start in that game? Was it, I don't remember off the top of it. Was it 11 for 11 or was it 16 for 16?
Yeah,
something,
I mean, he
ridiculous.
Wasn't, it wasn't downfield air yards or anything like that, but you don't necessarily need that. And we've seen it in the modern day NFL when you have the exotic smash mouth ground attack that San Francisco wants to employ.
Now, listen, Trey Lance has all the talent in the world. I mean, he is a create a player you make in a video game. He's 6'5", 230, rocket arm, pro style drop back passer, but mobile enough to not just run, but run you over. And I mean, we see Justin Fields running around in these preseason games, Todd. And even though their body compositions are similar, Trey Lance just looks like a different dude. So, I mean, Trey Lance has all the talent in the world. Talent that, you know, Jimmy G couldn't dream of having. But Trey Lance also just turned 21. This is a league where quarterbacks are playing into their late 30s. I have no idea why you want to rush that. And if you look at the history of this league, only two quarterbacks the last 70 years are younger than Trey Lance that have started day one. I mean, Trey Lance has played one meaningful game of football in 21 months. It was at the FCS level where he completed 50% of his passes in that game. To me...
Don't sleep on Central Arkansas, Payne. Do not sleep on the college football juggernaut that is Central Arkansas, the Fighting Scottie Pippins.
I'm okay starting Justin Fields day one for multiple reasons. Like, Andy Dalton isn't Jimmy G, and Justin Fields has played at the Power 5 level for more than, for one of the best programs, and he started multiple seasons at that level. I mean, let Trey Lance get his feet wet, and when he's ready, then it's go time, right? And that could be week 4, could be week 9, could be game 1 of 2022. Or shit, it could be the second quarter of game 1 this year if Jimmy G goes down. My gut says Jimmy G starts, and the last time he started and played a full season, he led the 49ers to a Super Bowl, completed over 69% of his passes that year. But I do think it's smart week to week to give Trey Lance a look with a package or two in short yardage and goal line situations. Like, make opponents waste time every single week preparing for something that you may not even use or use minimally, right? But I will say this, whoever's under center, they're going to get lots of help because Kyle Shanahan's designing the offense. He's calling the plays, which is a plus, plus, plus situation. You have a top 10 offensive line that added a veteran center that's familiar with the system and Alex Mack. You have Debo, Ayuk, and Kittle. That is a monster trio of weapons. Whatever flavor of running back you like, the 49ers have that as well. And you start to look at some of the other things, right, that could be a beneficiary to success for the 49ers. And they have the easiest schedule in the NFC West. The projected schedule of passing defenses is bottom 7. Last year it was top 5. Explosive passing defenses projects to be bottom 5. The 49ers last season faced the most difficult schedule of pass rushing defenses. That drops to below average. You have some of these, we'll call them bonus factors you look for when assessing teams and trying to peg positive regression. The 49ers were the most injured team in the NFL, both in terms of sheer numbers of games lost, but also value lost when you factor in who was injured and the positions that were injured. Some of the very worst fumble luck. And when you expand out and look at where these turnovers took place, the 49ers lost the most EPA on offense from turnovers. And then you rewind a little bit here, and this may tick some people off, but it's the reality. Monday, November 30th, Todd, when the city of Santa Clara decided to announce exorbitant COVID restrictions, that forced the 49ers without notice to move their entire operation. So they practiced and played in Arizona. 49ers only had 5 true home games all season. And 2 of those true home games were against Arizona and Los Angeles. So not a ton of travel benefit there. I mean, I can tell you, and you kind of mentioned the shift in odds within the division. 49ers are very sharp. This was something that I was a part of. We went over 10 wins on the 49ers. You're now looking at, 10.7, something along those lines. This is, I think the sharpest play within this division.
Hey, I mean, this is a good football team that was just besieged by injuries a season ago, and we haven't even really talked about the strength of what this team brings to the table, and I don't think we have to belabor the point, but from a defensive line perspective, all the notes that you read coming out of Santa Clara, that this group believes they have 8 to 10 bodies that would be capable of being starters, you wonder if the 49ers will move some of that depth to replace potential questions they may have in the secondary. Nick Bosa, D4, Javon Kinlaw. I mean, these guys are going to be extremely formidable when they're all healthy, ready to go. Fred Warner, they make a long commitment to, becomes the league's highest paid linebacker, was getting strong praise from around the league. And while you do have some questions I mentioned on the back end, hey, look, I mean, there's guys that are capable of being playmakers. So if they're able to solidify that group, this can become one of the stingiest stop units, not only in the NFC, but in the entire National Football League.
There is a little bit of a question with who's taking over. Obviously, everyone loves Robert Saleh. You have D'Amico Ryans is the new DC. If you remember him, he won Rookie of the Year when we were definitely watching football.
I had to honestly, Payne, when I saw that name come across, because I mean, I completely forgot. I mean, I knew they had to bring in a new DC, and I went, that name looks all familiar. He took his last snap in the NFL back in 2015. That's how I know we're really getting old around here.
Yes, it's really actually getting sad. I hate to even think of it. He's the youngest DC in the NFL, and he's been on this staff since 2017 when Lynch and Kyle came over. He's worked his way up from a defensive quality control coach to linebacker coach, and now obviously DC. He's been credited with the growth of Fred Warner and others. All of the players seem to say one thing about D'Amico Ryans, and it's how smart he is and how willing he is to teach. There was a quote, I believe it did come from Fred Warner, and basically he said, anybody can yell. That's not coaching. D'Amico will tell you what you did wrong, ask you what you saw or thought, and then actually sit down with you and show you what you did wrong and how to fix it. So all signs point to D'Amico Ryans having a real shot at being a good defensive coordinator here. He obviously, as you alluded to, inherits one of the best front sevens in football. Bosa returns after the ACL tear. Eric Armstead signed the big money deal that forced Buckner out. Armstead can line up outside and inside. Javon Kinlaw in year two with a real offseason should surge. There are a ton of nice little value signings along the D-line with Zach Kerr and Maurice Hurst and Samson Ebukam. And, you know, my feeling is Ebukam will be used properly. You know, a lot of guys, I think the Rams used him a little bit in drop coverage. He was better getting after the quarterback. You also have Dee Ford. Now, let's see if he can stay healthy. He had to restructure the contract. He's had this nagging back injury that I believe kept him out 15 games. It's being viewed as a bonus if he contributes anything, but so far having a great camp. If he can contribute, the defense goes to the next level. We talked about the linebackers being stacked with Dre Greenlaw and then obviously Fred Warner. He was the only linebacker to make Next Gen's top 10 pass coverage defenders in 2020. I mean, this is why he signed for Primo Bucks, because you need a linebacker that can cover in this day and age.
So it's not a question. Not a devalued position if you can cover in space, right? That's the one caveat
correct
to all of it.
That is the big caveat, right?
Yep.
Like, you can just throw anybody there, but if you have a guy who can cover, Primo Bucks. The question, and you hit this perfectly, is a secondary. You know, let's see if Jason Verrett can do it again and stay healthy for fairly, you know, the entire season. It's a unit that doesn't really have an elite guy. There's some depth questions. There's injury concerns through the roof with just about every single guy in that room missing substantial time semi-recently in their careers. And then you also have this factor of the 49ers are going to see an uptick in competition, right? They're going from an average schedule of opposing offenses last year to a projected top 10 schedule this year. A big increase in passing offenses from below average to top 10 as well, Todd. So there are some things here that do make me a little queasy, and it's typically the back end of this defense and the uptick in competition. And then obviously there's still, despite all the great things being said, some questions with D'Amico Ryans.
Before we get to the last team in the division, I want to ask you one question. I know you love these what-if games in terms of NFL roster NFL roster construction. Given the way the game is trending in 2021, if you had the choice to have an elite defensive line that could bring pressure on the quarterback with a mediocre secondary, or the converse, a mediocre defensive line in terms of getting pressure but an elite defensive backfield, which of those two options would you choose?
That's a trick question, because I don't think anyone has figured that out yet, but we are trending towards the possibility in terms of value shifting towards cornerback, as shockingly as that is going to sound, because there are ways to manufacture pressure. There's not ways to manufacture elite cover corners. And so there is this little trend right now that is catching steam that says an elite cover corner is better than an elite edge rusher, but it's minimal, that difference right now. Those are the two premier positions.
There is a method to my madness a lot of the time, as unorthodox as it may be. And the reason
you're going to say, let's trade one of our defensive linemen for an elite corner.
No.
Who would you like?
No, I wasn't going to go that route. I was going to use this as the perfect segue into the Seattle Seahawks, and I'll get there in a second. It'll all come full circle. who, when you look at Seattle, they're plus 280 at FanDuel Sportsbook to win the NFC West. Their win total sits at 10 flat, so lay a buck 10 either way, depending if you want to go over and under. 12 wins for the Seahawks was the most since 2014. Only the Chiefs, Ravens, and Saints have 10-plus wins in each of the last three seasons. But the one crazy part for Seattle, 18 of their 23 wins the last few seasons have all been decided by one score, and we talk about sustainability, but it's clearly a byproduct of the Russell Wilson effect, where he's gone 98-45-1, leading the Seahawks since he took over, a record only bettered by the Pats. We'll get to the Seahawks offense and Russ in a second, but the reason I ask about the secondary, when you look at Seattle, this is a team who's invested a lot of money in their linebacker position. I think we're both high on Jordan Brooks. We know what Bobby Wagner is. They spent an inordinate amount of money in a guy who at least is listed as a member of the defensive backfield in Jamal Adams, but you have some questions about Seattle's ability to cover in space, and more importantly, the Seahawks, their ability to get pressure with their front four.
Yeah, listen, I think people qualified enough to evaluate Seattle from the outside. This is going to sound so fucking bad.
I can't
wait.
They
do a much better job than the people within the organization at times. Pete and others believe that their defense can be relied on and be dominant similar to the championship years. And it's just not the case. They wholeheartedly believe the defense is great. And that's why Pete neutered the offense last year. Now, give Seattle some credit. Down the stretch last year, their weighted defense was 11th in efficiency, so they did perform better towards the end of the year. And it helped that the offensive schedule decreased at the same time Jamal Adams got healthy and they added Carlos Dunlap via trade. So, you know, and there's lots of optimism this year around Jordan Brooks in his athleticism, so much so that Seattle let KJ Wright walk because Brooks brings more speed. Now, as a rookie, Brooks played 160 snaps in coverage. He gave up over 10 yards per reception and had a 29 coverage grade, which was horrific. The secondary is extremely vulnerable in pass coverage. I know we all like Quandre Diggs. Jamal Adams is fantastic getting after the quarterback, but he delivered his lowest coverage grade ever last season. He is a liability in coverage. Now, in saying that, if you can make Adams strictly a box safety, a blitzer, because he is the team's best pass rusher, I believe he delivered like a 21% pressure rate, there is a sizable difference with Seattle's splits when Adams was on the field versus when he wasn't, if you are willing to use him as a box safety and a blitzer. Opponents had a negative EPA when Adams was off, was on the field. And then opponents had a positive EPA when Adams wasn't. So Seattle was clearly better with Adams on the field because they figured out how to use him post-Patriots game where he basically got completely shredded by Cam. From that moment on, he just became a blitzer, basically, and just crushing souls in the box. That's what he needs to be. The other thing that Seahawks fans won't be happy about is the defense sees a massive uptick in competition. And that's big for a unit that was clearly impacted by its opponent, because I think it's worth mentioning here, obviously, right, when you play tougher offenses, it's tougher to defend, but there's less of a dip when you're a really good defense or an elite defense. But when you're a middling defense, schedule is very important. And so Seattle's going from facing a bottom five schedule of offenses to a projected top 10 schedule. And for a unit that has trouble getting after the quarterback, Seattle projects to face the very best pass blocking O-lines this year. So a guy like LJ Collier has to wake up and pretend to remember he was drafted 29th overall in 2019. This just feels like a middling defense that still has some clear holes, Todd.
I mean, you've taught me extremely well when you assess a defense and some of their metrics. You obviously look at the competition that they've played. I was blown away, Payne, when you look at the team being 30th in scoring defense the first 9 weeks, number one in the final nine, and then you understand why they were able to create a resurrection. Not only did they run the ball more offensively and the defense was on the field for a lot less snaps and possessions, you played Jared Goff twice, Alex Smith, a hurt Kyler Murray, the Philadelphia Eagles, the Jets, the Giants, and the 49ers. with the dynamic fourth-string quarterback in Jacksonville known as C.J. Beathard. So clearly things were going to improve compared to what you saw early in the year. But we'll see exactly what this team is defensively, because from the offensive standpoint, Shane Waldron takes over. He's the former Rams pass game coordinator for Brian Schottenheimer, who was fired at the end of the season. And we can start with the highlights. They set a franchise record last year, more than 28 points per game. Clearly a separation first half versus second half. Russell Wilson's numbers more than showed that, despite him completing a career high completion percentage wise and touchdowns. He had 28 touchdowns where he accounted for the first eight games, 14 over the last nine. We know what Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf can do. A backfield that should be healthier and have more game breakers as they continue to figure out the depth there. But what kind of expectations should we realistically have for a Seattle offense that was diametrically opposed last season? And we're not exactly sure what we're going to get to kick off the 2021 campaign.
Shane Waldron has some good traits about him. You know, he comes over from the Rams. He was their passing game coordinator under McVay the last few seasons, so he clearly is going to have a clue. All the reports are that this guy is just chomping at the bit. He is a natural leader. Pete Carroll has praised him for how he talks to the team. So from the sounds of things, there should be improvement from Seattle's offense. We're hearing faster tempo. More no huddle. Even when huddled, expect Seattle to get in and out of it faster. Waldron's giving Russ the go-ahead to change plays and audible if he doesn't like what he sees. Talks of Russ using more play action. Fully expect Russ to get the ball out of his hands quicker. We know O-line issues have been a constant for Seattle's organization over the years, but Russ can assist in that. And he can help things improve by not holding on to the ball for nearly 3 seconds before every pass, which is, well, you know, what he's been doing. He had the fifth slowest release time last year. All of these new possibilities sound great. But the question becomes, and it's really tough to say this about, you know, a guy who's had a ton of success at the college level and the NFL level and won championships at both. But even if all of these things help Seattle's offense, none of us know if Pete Carroll's going to suddenly get a wild hair up his ass and squash the offensive progress like a bug, right? And just neuter the attack like he did last season. None of us have that crystal ball. And so it's really important to outline this. I know we talked about it ad nauseum last year, especially towards the latter parts of the season. But if you look at Seattle the first 10 weeks last year, they passed the ball at the highest rate in the league on early downs, and own the highest total success rate in the league over that stretch. That wasn't good enough for Pete, right? After they lost back-to-back games against Buffalo and the Rams, he demanded Brian Schottenheimer to stop what he was doing and run more. So from week 11 onward, Seattle on first and second down became pretty balanced. 50% run pass, and no shock here, their success and efficiency dwindled. And so when you look at what truly unfolded down the stretch, it was really three things. Pete Carroll neutered the offense. The schedule of opposing defenses increased. And the defenses also chose to stick another defender deep and play some version of a cover two or cover two man or quarters defense. But effectively, it was a too high look, to not get overly confusing here. And once teams started doing that, Schottenheimer and Russ never really adjusted. They kept trying to bomb the ball deep. And if you look at the first 9 weeks, Russ took deep shots on almost 13% of his passes. Those resulted in a positive 0.54 EPA. He was on target with 62% of those deep passes. But once teams dropped that second deep defender from weeks 10 through 17, Russ still threw it deep almost 12% of the time, but his on-target rate dipped to 40%, and his EPA on those 20-plus yard throws dropped to a negative 0.15 EPA. So there wasn't this adjustment from Brian Schottenheimer, and that's kind of the sword Pete Carroll made him fall on, was he wasn't able to adapt or adjust. Well, I mean, he kind of stripped this confidence away after really doing well the first 10 or so games. So, you know, I think the hope is if you're Shane Waldron, you can execute your offense with a little more tempo than last year. You can pass the ball in early downs at an above average rate. but you can shorten some of the concepts, right, to make the pass game not so predictable. If you can convince Pete, like, hey, you know, the shorter, quicker passes are an extension of the ground game, and we're also not getting Russ killed because he's releasing it quicker, we may have something here. Now, it's awesome that a first-time OC gets to work with Russ, but what does suck is Waldron's offense projected to face the most difficult schedule of defenses and passing defenses. 9 games against defenses that finish top 10 in EPA, so he does have his work cut out for him from that perspective, as well as massaging what he actually wants to do offensively to Pete.
You know, it's one of the teams that's confounded on so many levels the last couple of years. I mean, I know I mentioned the one-score games and how Russell Wilson becomes the great eraser for a lot of the deficiencies on this Seattle team. But in reality, you wonder how long he can continue to pull this team along if he's not given the support. Because you talked about it. Seattle still believes that they have an elite-level defense or something close to it. That's a far cry from the Legion of Boom defense that allowed them to be so successful when Russ was kind of learning the offense and they were able to reach all sorts of heights back in 2014-ish and thereabouts. So we'll see exactly what we have. Have we seen professionals kind of take a stance on the Seahawks as far as their overall season outlook in this very difficult division?
I have not. That is one thing I have not seen. Now, some of the guys I talked to, and it's really funny because you can just tell how difficult this division is. It was like, hey, assess the NFC West, then let's all join up and have a conversation. And so it came back with a couple on San Francisco. One guy liked Arizona. Another guy liked Seattle. Everyone seemed to kind of want to fade the Rams' momentum and hype, but nothing convincing on Seattle. There were some conversations of a to-make-the-playoffs bet, but nothing has come to fruition there yet.
It's always interesting. I mean, a handful of these teams year in, year out become more polarizing than anything else, and you get a better indication of how they're going to perform when you judge him on the merits week to week, more so than an entire season long outlook. And I think Seattle kind of fits that bill when we approach them in the 2021 season. Perfect time to remind you to follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. All the contest details right there. One link. It's easy to follow. Click, sign up. We're up to about 1,500 entrants so far. Want to more than double that. Love to be able to get over 4,000. So tell your friends, tell your families, tell people you don't like, your coworkers. It's the perfect way to keep them busy Wednesday, Thursdays, and Fridays throughout the fall and create some of that water cooler conversation. Also, FanDuel.com/bet the board. Go to FanDuel.com. All new users entitled to a $1,000 free bet. Take full advantage of some generous promotions that are there. As we mentioned, FanDuel will be live in the state of Arizona, hopefully in time for football season. So this is the perfect time for all you folks out there, Cardinal fans or otherwise, to take advantage and begin building your bankroll just in time for kickoff. Payne, only 4 teams left to go, and we saved your beloved Patrick Mahomes for the final preview podcast. We'll, of course, get to that on Monday when we break down the AFC West in great detail. But before we close up shop here this fine Thursday morning, wasn't sure if there was a best bet or an investment opportunity you saw worth making at this stage in the game.
Yeah, this is something we bet just yesterday, and I hate to be reactionary. I kind of always want to dive into markets and set the tone and not kind of react to news. But I do think it was interesting with what came out of Denver yesterday. And I personally would have went in a different direction as a coach or GM. And I would have given Drew Lock the initial shot because I know Mahomes is in my division. Herbert is in my division and I'm trying to win championships and Lock gives me a better ceiling. However, as a bettor, I truly have no issues going with the higher floor because 9 wins, 10 wins is perfect for me. So let's go with the over 8.5 -05 at FanDuel on the Denver Broncos. What I do like about this situation is you have a Teddy Bridgewater who is loaded with gobs of talent around him. He is not going to lose you the game. When you look at the opening schedule, there's a lot of opportunity to start 3-0 and build some confidence among a young receiver group. I also like the idea that Teddy Bridgewater last year in Carolina faced one of the most difficult schedules of passing defenses, and now he's going to be going against the easiest schedule of passing defenses this year. When you look at Vic Fangio, the guy's an absolute monster defensively, one of the best defensive minds in all of football. You add a Patrick Surtain, you get healthy along the defensive line. I think this is going to be one of the best defenses in football. And so I like the makeup of Denver here. And I think even if they are the third best team in the division, that they can easily get to 9 wins. And what's really interesting, I don't want to kind of spoil this because we'll get to the NFC West on Monday.
No. Go into a deep dive on the Broncos.
What do we know? What do we know of the Chargers at this point? I love Justin Herbert as well, but we have a head coach and he's kind of being anointed as like the next whiz kid, and that's awesome. But defensively, he got this job based upon a huge breakout year with Donald and Jalen Ramsey and just a shit schedule of offenses he faced. Do we know his defense is that great, or was it a byproduct of elite talent and a really shit schedule? So I don't know what the Chargers are. They seem to be one of those like flash teams, and there was some pro money on their win total over, but I don't think we actually know what the Chargers are. So there could be some potential value there, and the Raiders, oof. I mean, I'm not quite sure what.
Don't worry.
So I like the composition of this Denver team. I think there's a lot of talent there. I think the offensive line improves. I like Javonte Williams, obviously. So I think they upgraded at running back. Tons of talent out wide. And you have a game manager in Teddy Bridgewater that's not going to lose you games. And I do get a vibe. Could be wrong. I could be giving him too much credit. I do get a vibe with this easier schedule of passing defenses that we see him push the ball maybe a touch more down the field this year. That's my hope.
Don't worry, the Raiders went out and they got Denzel Perryman, so all is well as far as the Raiders' defense is concerned yesterday. And I thought you were going to go into a full-scale Denver Broncos breakdown here. I mean, we only had 3 teams to cover on Monday to lighten the workload, but I mean, you stopped yourself short in the tracks to do that. So Denver Broncos definitely makes a ton of sense. It'll be interesting to see how that team is viewed throughout the course of the season. You talked about it, defensive-minded head coach. And, of course, we'll do Denver a deep dive of sorts for all the things Payne highlighted on Monday when we wrap things up on the preview front. Any final words of wisdom, life advice, things you'd like to share as we inch ever so close to week 0 of college football, Payne, before we turn our lives over entirely, as if we haven't been doing that already since the middle of July, to this lovely craft of ours we call handicapping NFL and college football?
No, I think that's it. Talk to everyone on Monday.
All righty. Get better, my friend. And to all of you out there, best of luck with any of your preseason NFL Week 3 wagers, however you choose to approach the College Board this weekend. Most importantly, though, with a Denver Broncos ticket in hand, come the middle of December, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.